Welcome, folks. This is Mark Steiner right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Every year we do the one book, one Maryland one book, and each of these pick an interesting book, sometimes more interesting than others, and this year is a really interesting book. It's called All American Boys, and it's written by two men. It's a novel written by, that doesn't happen often when two people write a novel together. Jason Reynolds and Brendan Kiley put this book together, and it's an amazing story that crosses racial lines. One author is white, one author is black. They write from those perspectives. They talk about something that's very real in our world today. We all live through Freddie Gray, wherever you're living, and listening to this around the country, you've gone through a Freddie Gray experience in your lives and in your community's lives, I should say. And it's amazing how they've kind of created this world between approach from a white author and a black author writing one novel together, and they're here in the studio, and it's just great to have them here. Jason and Brendan, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thank you, man. Thank you
very much.
Thanks
so much. Glad to be here.
It is amazing. I mean, at first, you know, I said, what is this book? But then I said,
exactly.
What is this book? But then I read it. First let me start this. Let's take a step back. So, I mean, you're writing about a young black man who gets beaten up by the police very severely and a white guy who witnesses. Go to the same school. We'll get into the story like that in a moment. But how did you end up doing this work together? Where did you all meet, and how did you end up doing this together?
Yeah. So Brendan and I met a few years back. The publishing company put us on tour together for different books. I had written a book called When I Was the Greatest, and he had written a book called The Gospel of Winter. And they figured that if they put us on tour together, we could drum up more of an interest in our novels.
Was there any connection between the novels?
There was no connection between them. No connection between them. Actually, he had written a novel about the abuse scandal in the Catholic Church, and I had written a novel about a kid with Tourette syndrome.
And living in different worlds.
A very different world in a wealthy white community in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn.
Wow.
And so we were on, but so that's sort of the beginning of this whole thing. But it just so happened that this tour began shortly after the George Zimmerman verdict. And so my mother called me, and she's crying, and she's angry, and she's frustrated, and she's afraid for me, and all this, that, and the third.
A lot of black families made that phone call that day.
There were a lot of black families who made that phone call.
Right,
and
right.
And what complicated it for me was that I was frustrated and upset. But on tour with a stranger who was white and outside of my cultural community who I did not know. And so, you know, I always joke about the adult rules, right? We all have these stupid rules like religion and politics, right? Off the table when you just meet somebody and so forth and so on. And so I couldn't talk about it because I was afraid that he wouldn't connect and then he wouldn't relate. And then we'd have to still stick together for the rest of this tour. But it came up haphazardly at some point, and he was as upset as I was and as frustrated as I was. And so we created this sort of safe space for the two of us to be vulnerable and to be confused and to be upset and to cry and scream without him trying to fix me or defend anything. And we continued to have the uncomfortable conversations month after month and all the way up until Michael Brown was killed in Ferguson. And that was the final straw and the impetus that would eventually become All American.
Do you all live near each other?
Well, at the time we did. I mean, we were both living in New York at the time. So when we decided that we wanted to work on the book together, it was convenient.
For a moment.
Because then, when we agreed we were going to write the book together, I think it was the next week I promptly moved to Italy for the year. So we wrote the book across the ocean from each other.
Which we can do in this day's world between the internet and Skype and whatever else.
Exactly. Right? We would have these kind of Skype conversations as we would, you know, so the first part of the first chapter, we had to get a lot of details together so that the stories match. Because for those who have not yet read the book, it's two slightly parallel stories. And each chapter contains half the chapter is Rashad Butler's voice and half the chapter is Quinn Collins' voice. And each chapter is a day in the week of these two teens' lives. And so that first chapter, a lot happens where they're both in the scene basically together, although not realizing it. And that we had to coordinate. But after that, because this book emerges out of that friendship that Jason was talking about, because it emerges actually out of the space between us as opposed to either one of us individually, we had an enormous amount of trust and we just let each other roll. And we wrote these books. We wrote these books and wove them together the fact.
Let me take it as an example. So you have one character, the white character.
Yeah.
And his father is gone. He was killed in the war in Afghanistan.
Right.
Right. This is all American kid, as he's describes himself being described.
Yeah. I like throwing that term in quotes because it's something we should interrogate.
Right. No, we exactly what you do.
Yeah.
And the other character, Rashad, grows up in a home not poverty stricken, right? Middle class home, but basically in ROTC. His father is an ex soldier, his father is an ex cop. Pretty tight on him.
Absolutely.
Right? On his butt, his life.
Yep.
Then he gets confronted by this cop for something he did not do in a store and gets really, he could have been beaten to death, but he was beaten very severely.
Yeah.
And the other kid witnesses it.
Right.
So that's the kind of basis that starts the story from, right?
Yeah. Right.
Just give our listeners a sense who haven't read the book.
Yeah, no,
I appreciate that. So then how did you then start, when you said you wrote the chapters, or you wrote together, how did you do that? I mean, did you write only from Rashad's perspective? Did you write only from Quinn's perspective? I mean, how did you, and then put it together? So what did you do?
Yes. The easy answer is yes. I wrote specifically from Rashad's perspective, and Brendan wrote specifically from Quinn's perspective because we wanted to make sure that we were bringing experiential truth and authenticity to the story, right? I don't know what it means to be a Quinn Collins because I have lived in black skin my entire life. This has been my experience. This has been my world. And so I wanted to make sure that I brought a nuanced tale to the story. What we did, though, is we, and I've been asking Brendan to find this napkin. I'm certain he has lost the napkin, but we wrote, because he keeps skirting it.
Where is that napkin?
Where is it?
No, blew his nose, it's gone.
So we were sitting in a coffee shop, and we jotted down literally just characteristics, a really loose sort of skeleton. It's like, all right, what are the non-negotiables? Number one, Rashad Butler will not be a basketball player, first and foremost.
But Quinn will be a basketball player.
Quinn will be a basketball player.
But Rashad will not. Number two, they will not know each other. They do not know each other. Number three, Rashad, like, just even the concept of him being middle class, right? Like, he's not. Because I think when we think about police brutality, there's a stereotype of the victim as well as the stereotype of the police officer. And I wanted to make sure that we bucked that a bit because it's not true most of the time. And then we literally, like, once we got the details of the first chapter, we just let ourselves do our thing. Just tell your truth. I'm going to tell my truth. And because we had spent 6 months talking every single day about the issue, it's funny how, like, it's like having a sibling or a partner where it's like, I know you well enough to know what you will do and what you will say and what you will write. And over time, that's what started to happen. We only swapped chapters like 2 or 3 times.
So, but who then, as you wrote this together, there are all these other characters around the main characters, men and young men and women, and some teachers as well, parents. How did you develop, who created these characters? Did you create all the characters around the police officer's family? Did you make them up? Did you have a part in making them up? You know, and on the basketball team that's mostly black, but for about 4 white players. I mean, how did you all develop these people?
So I think I appreciate that because it's a more in-depth question than we often get asked. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I think is important is that just like in friendship, you got to be a good listener. And so
that's the whole battle, actually.
To me. And so in writing this together, so I got Jason's first chapter first, and I was writing my first chapter at the same time, but I got to read his first chapter
before you wrote yours.
Well, no, while I was writing mine. Uh-huh. But we're, again, because at the beginning we're in their kind of 2 independent friend groups. So then I met Rashad's friends, and we knew that we were going to have some crossover on the basketball team, so that we could have characters interact from both narratives. And I got to meet those characters, and then I could try to, you know, incorporate them in my scenes loosely here and there to begin to tie things together. And likewise, you know, as we proceeded, and there were moments of, right now I had a character in my scene, in my section, for example, who worked at the hospital. But it didn't make sense for me to keep that character in the hospital because then we would need to see her interacting with Rashad more. So partway through the process of writing the book, I just cut that role for that character. So we did have communication throughout the process because otherwise it would be next to impossible. But the vast majority of it really was this sense of trust. And so building the basketball team, I wrote some scenes incorporating in particular English, and then after I had worked on that, I'd go back to Jason and say, you know,
So when you wrote
let's,
like this,
let's
one
work
scene
on we, this together a little bit more.
So before when we started the conversation, yeah. That's one of actually the parts I picked out maybe to read if we have time. But there's a scene in there where Edwards, right? Why am I blacking the names here? The black basketball player.
English.
I don't know why I keep changing his name to Edwards. English.
Yeah.
It's my head. I'm sorry. So English, mm-hmm. Who knows Rashad.
Yeah.
And they're tight.
His best friend. Yeah.
Right, his best friend. And so they get into this, they're in practice and they're working on these weight machines and they get into this dialogue back and forth. Now, when I read that dialogue, the conversation between the two of them sounded very real to me. In terms of what a white kid might say and what a black kid might say in response and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So you were in the middle of that somewhere, right?
Only a little bit. I didn't have anything to do with that part of the story. What I did do is just edit for voice. Uh-huh. That's it. So he had written the entire dialogue. And then I went in and said, look.
So it rang true to you when you read it?
Absolutely. Except, right. Except you know, there are certain nuances in the lexicon that he can't know, right? And so I would go in and say, can we just change this word to this? Or can we change that word to that? That's it. But the dialogue is good. But just for voice reasons, can we change this word or that word? Because when I'm writing English, I'm coming from a much closer point of view, obviously, as a black male and who was a black teenager. So my voice, like, I know that voice. That's my authentic voice. And so I would have to just make sure that voice is matched up. But I didn't touch the dialogue at all.
So in the process of doing that, so you wrote about English and Rashad and the others before this?
Yes.
Right?
They're all in the first scene.
Right. So I'm saying, English is one of your...
English is my character.
It's your character.
Yeah.
That you then played with.
Right.
Did you play with Guzzo at all, the brother of the cop?
I didn't have to because Rashad was in the hospital the whole time. Right, so who I'm writing at the point of view, he never
right.
leaves the hospital.
Okay, right. All right.
I do want to add one thing though, because I especially when speaking about race in America as a white person, I think it's what we're talking about in a literary sense is important for white folks to think about in a political sense as well, on the big picture in America, and that's part of the motivation for writing this book. So I like to say, since we're talking about the process of aesthetically partnering. Working on a literary partnership together, and we're talking about the process of me listening to those characters that I meet in the first chapter as I'm reading through it, knowing that I'm going to have to find ways to incorporate them in scenes later when they're basketball teams at practice. I like to make the point that I think as a white person in America, I need to do a better job listening to the experiential truth of people of color talking about what's going on in their communities around the country. Because the very beginning of the book is a poem that begins, zoom in, zoom in, zoom in. And our hope is that you kind of think about this like as if you are on your couch and you're watching, what's going on in the news one day after another, whether you're in Charlotte or Tulsa or Ferguson or, we could name the cities across the country. Witnessing this news story, that you kind of get off the couch and enter the story. And for me as a white person and speaking directly to, white folks across the country, we've got to do a better job listening to the voices and the truths coming out of communities of color. And so I like this conversation about the literary approach because I think it leads us to the conversation about the politics as well.
So I'm curious when you were writing all this, because as I said, I thought they were very real. Come from both worlds, and the interactions between the two seemed very real to me. I want to talk about some interactions, the reactions you felt from young people as you've gone across the country with this. But first, I'm curious, did either of you have revelations from the other's work as you were rolling, things you learned that were not, that you didn't think about or weren't part of your mental vocabulary when you're talking about race on the other side?
You know what? So I'll say this. There are things, honestly, for me on my side, there are things that I hadn't thought about on the black perspective that were illuminated in the writing of the story. And one of the biggest moments was the concept of like, all right, brutality is happening all around us. But when we think of brutality, we think of death. And so what happens to the people who have been brutalized and who survive and who have to die a death every day, especially in today's time when the immediacy of martyrdom is upon us, right? So, like, it's immediate. The moment that you have been brutalized or have been abused, then you are instantly sort of turned into the new flag to wave to further a particular movement. And that oftentimes, which we don't ever think about, strips you of your humanity, strips your family of the time and space they need to grieve either the loss of a loved one or the brutalization of a loved one. And if you're a young person, what is it like to relive that every time you turn on the television, every time you turn on the internet, every time you see somebody, everyone around you is looking at you, you having to relive the brutalization. And I had never thought about it that way until writing the story. So a lot of Rashad's issue is that he has to stew in the truth of being brutalized, which is psychologically injuring, psychologically traumatic in a way that I don't think that I had ever thought about until it just kind of came up in the book.
That's an important piece. I'll say something about that later, man.
I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Jason, but I believe that a really influential librarian, Dr. Rudine Bishop, really kind of coined a phrase about windows and mirrors in literature. And I think our book, in many ways, I'll speak from my own perspective as a white writer and white reader. I think there is a window into the black experience that I can peek into by reading through Rashad's narrative. And as a white reader and white writer, there's a mirror reflecting Quinn Collins' experience for me. And I think it works vice versa. And of course, it's not just black and white. I think we can, draw this out a little bit more. But that's I really appreciate Dr. Bishop's phrase, because I think it's important for books to have that opportunity to, as you're suggesting, look into an experience that is not your own. Maybe that fosters empathy in some way, and also to reflect back, as Jason's talking about, in a way that maybe you hadn't even thought of in your own cultural experience. And so my first response to your question, too, would then be, I, too, was going through that kind of like looking deeper and more closely in the mirror of white identity and really deconstructing that word racist. It's so easy to call the KKK racist, but often I think it's much harder to think about the moments that as a white person where I'm perpetuating a system that is inherently racist. And to interrogate that and interrogate myself in that way was what I was trying to do with Quinn's character. In terms of looking into the getting a view into the black experience, I think part of what is really powerful about the story in general and is thinking a lot about the connections between family, the kind of the concerns that the mothers both have in both sides that in fact seem so similar. This unbelievable care about, I don't know what the right thing for you to do is. I don't know if you should act or not because I care too much about your body. I care too much about, you know, what's going to happen to you if you go out there. And that was a real interesting window for me because...
Did you come to those conclusions independently about the mothers?
Absolutely.
Yeah, totally independent.
Absolutely. And that was powerful for me when reading Jason's sections because it made me think a lot about the how similar so many of the conversations could be.
Yeah, yeah.
They're different because of experience, but the similarity there and that kind of care and concern.
I was thinking, just to the listeners again, that we're talking right now to the two authors of a novel, these two men, one black man, one white man, together. Jason Reynolds and Brendan Kiley wrote the book All American Boys, which is the one Maryland one book for this year. And they are in our studio here talking about the book. And it's an amazing book, I think. I mean, it was really – I didn't know what to think at first. You know, you look at things and you do this so often, sometimes you get a little jaundiced and go, is this kind of hokey or what? But really.
No, I can imagine.
You know, I must say I thought that it was this is really well done and really important for people to wrestle with. So I'm curious how it's been received, because you've gone around the country with this book, right?
Yeah.
And how it's been received by different audiences. I mean, black audiences versus white audiences,
sure. Yeah.
Poor working class black kids versus upper middle class black kids or white kids or more working class white kids.
Right.
Was there a difference in how people perceived and responded to this book?
So this is always an interesting question. And Brendan and I, over the course of the last year, have spoken to upwards of around 30,000 students.
Wow.
And all over the country.
Wow.
And the funniest, and we're talking about from prison populations to poor black alternative schools to wealthy, wealthy white schools, including Gilman, right?
Well, here in Baltimore,
absolutely.
Yeah.
To, you know, poor white schools. I mean, all over the country, all these different sort of demographics. And the funniest part is that when it comes to the young people, the experience has pretty much been exactly the same.
What does that mean?
So there are, and I always say this, there are three things that exist in every single space, two of which are always present: fear, confusion, and anger. Right, when you're talking to these young folks, right? And so if we're in a poor white, if we're in a wealthy white neighborhood, usually we're talking about fear and confusion. If we're in a poor black neighborhood, usually we're talking about fear and anger. If we're in, I mean, literally these two things of the three, there are always two that are accessible no matter who we're talking to, all around this country. And we ask the same questions, right? The questions are the same. Number one, how many of you know about police brutality? 100% of the kids raise their hand. Number two, how many of you have talked about it with your friends and everybody puts their hands down? And it doesn't matter where we are, including in Ferguson, Missouri. The only people, actually, we always joke, the only students that actually kept their hands up was Baltimore City.
Yeah.
And so, which is interesting. And so what we learned as we kept traveling around was that it's not that they don't want to talk about it. Because at the end of our presentation, they all have their hands up for questions. It's just they don't have the framework. No one's providing a tool, right? A framework, a safe space for them to have an uncomfortable conversation. It's hard to talk. You're 15 years old and you can't find the language to put around what's happening around you. It can get a bit complicated and a bit messy. And so what All American Boys seems to be doing is creating that buffer and that space for them to have the discourse. And it's everywhere, no matter who we're talking to. White kids who are like, we don't know what to do. We're afraid. We want to do the right thing, but we don't know what the right thing is in these moments because I don't want to say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing. Or black kids who are like, what am I supposed to do? Is racism ever going to end? What can we do to fix this issue? And I think it's been really motivating, and for me at least, it's been hopeful.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that it is inspiring to be around the young folks and to hear their questions, to feel their energy. I mean, that's really part of it. They're yearning to talk about what they see on their social media every damn day, and they want to process it with I think really with people that they, whether they are teasing or not, are looking up to. They're looking up to older folks to help provide, you know, leadership, role models, open door for communication, a safe space to have this conversation. So they're yearning for it, and they have the eagerness, the curiosity, the passion, the confusion, the fear, the anger, all of these things. So I feel inspired because I feel like I owe it to them, and so we're wherever we go, there's always that passion, there's always that energy, and it's also true that we are talking sometimes with older folks as well, book clubs in senior centers, libraries that are hosting some of those, and those really fascinate me as well because, as Jason often talks about, like, you know, we get older, we carry more scars. And there are different kinds of scars and calluses, and with them come assumptions and biases, and so, you know, in those conversations, those are sometimes a little different, and I like kind of even teasing those audiences a bit with, well, here's what the young folks are willing to talk about. Are you willing to talk about it as honestly? Because I think it's pretty encouraging when we listen to the kids and. Yeah. And they talk about their lives. I mean, that's what they're doing.
And we get banned.
They're just talking about their lives.
We've been banned and disinvited. And all we, you know.
Really?
Banned by,
what do you mean?
There are a lot of adults who are terrified of us and terrified of this book because they feel like that their young people aren't ready for the conversation. So we're talking about, and you know, I can't say the names, obviously, but, you know, Baton Rouge and Texas and New Jersey. And, I mean, all these, so many places that have invited us to come and give a keynote or come give a presentation and then have disinvited us. Once the book has moved up the chain and as they're going through all the box checking and it gets to the higher ups and they're like, no way, absolutely not. And the most interesting thing about it is that all the adults, for the adults who are like, come anyway, we're a little reticent, but come anyway. When we get there, everyone's like tiptoeing and eggshelling and the kids are like, we're so ready to have the discussion. Right, so the adults, the insecurity of adults, oftentimes is the most hindering element of the youth.
No, exactly. No, this, and I think that people give. I've been saying this a lot in the air lately. That I think that we give real short shrift to this generation coming up.
Yeah.
I think they're amazing, actually.
So good to hear somebody else say that.
Right? Absolutely. It's so
they're
great
amazing.
To hear
I
get so tired of people saying this is a waste generation.
A lost generation,
They're not lost. They're actually opening doors and opening their eyes and minds, and they're much different than what happened before. I think because of the history of struggle that went before them and all the things that they see, they're beginning to question what is going on around them.
Absolutely.
Without the courage of the folks who are part of the Black Lives Matter movement, you wouldn't see white newscasters on TV today talking about white privilege and Black Lives Matter.
Right.
And that comes from that energy of of those younger folks who are really, you know, galvanizing that movement. Hats off to them.
No, I agree. I agree. I mean, there's so much good stuff in here. I mean, so a couple of quick things. So there's one character, the cop's name is Galuzzo, who beat up Rashad. And really compelling the way that was – that particular scene was written, I thought. It was explosive. And, you know, I mean, when you write a book, one of the things that's it's really important, I think, is that the beginning of the book be explosive enough to keep people inside the book. Right?
Absolutely.
So
I really appreciate that.
And y'all did that. So,
yeah.
But – so I'm curious. Question for you, I think. Let me start with Galuzzo. If anything, did you learn from Galuzzo and Galuzzo's characters in this book from your perspective? And what do you think kids might have learned from it from their perspective?
You know, so that's an interesting one that no one also has ever asked. I appreciate that. I think for me, the interesting thing about Paul Galuzzo, for me at least, was understanding that, one, Paul Galuzzo it's funny because I wrote the first chapter, but I always think about the scenes before Paul Galuzzo got to work that day, right? Which are not written. But it's...
Well, getting a good actual writer has to be in your head.
It's
in
my head, right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Right. And so I always think about, we're getting the snapshot of Paul and Rashad, but Paul... the way that scene unfolds makes it makes it super clear that either this wasn't the first time that he was itching. You know, like there's like I always tell the young folks, Rashad was guilty when he walked in the door. Rashad was guilty, even though he wasn't guilty. But when he walked in the door, he had stepped into the lion's den and he didn't know. And it was almost as if they were waiting for. Waiting for something, whether it was Rashad or the next kid who walked in the door, that today was the day, right? And I always wonder about, and Brendan always says, you know, we refuse to believe that there are people who wake up in the morning and twist their evil mustaches and say, like, today I'm going to wreak havoc, right? Like, I don't believe that Paul is that guy, but I do think that Paul, because that story, and I set it up by saying the story had been robbed several times, Paul has an implicit bias, a severe bias, that sort of showed that reared its head, and I think that happens all the time. We see it all the time, and I think the hard part is the one question we've been getting a lot lately, especially here in Maryland, is what about Paul? What about Paul? What about Paul? Like people want us to sort of like give Paul a third of the story, but I honestly feel like we've given Paul enough of the story. I think that what you see is a man who was fully fleshed out. Brendan wrote a story about a man who was fleshed out. He's a human being. We know he's a human. He's a hero in the community in which he lives and serves. But he is not without the toxin that is implicit bias and prejudice in America.
Right.
Period. And he has the power to do it
right. And
to not be affected by it.
And then that's part of the beauty of this as well. I think is that understand that he. Which you said about him, he's here in his community and people like him. His little brother loves him. His mother loves him.
He makes the best burgers on the block.
He makes the
guy.
Best burgers on the block,
he's
right?
He's the basketball coach. He's the guy,
yeah.
You know?
Right? But the insidiousness of, as I always put it, of racism in America that is in the marrow. You don't even know you have it.
Exactly.
Yes.
It's
absolutely.
In the marrow.
Right?
Absolutely, it is.
It's tethered to the fibers of this country, and no one wants to talk.
That's what you're trying to do here.
That's what we're trying to. That's all we're really trying to talk about, right? Is that this is something that is in our country's DNA, and we keep thinking that these are paper cuts on the skin, and we're like, no, no, no. This is at the core of this country.
I mean, sometimes as we explain to the young folks and you see the heads nodding in the audience, that we in this instance we're talking about law enforcement because it's such a prevalent, explosive, in-your-face representation of how implicit bias can really cause damage. But we could talk about systemic racism and implicit bias in food justice, in housing, in healthcare, in education, in any institution in America, an organization in America. And my hope is that many folks feel inspired to tell those stories and do that. But in our instance, we're talking about law enforcement. And I really love your phrase about it being in the marrow, or as Jason says, in the DNA of our country, because it is the country is you know, there have been 400 years plus of violence against black bodies in the United States. And for us to pretend that, you know, a civil rights movement in the 60s and 70s wiped that all away is dangerous ignorance. And so, as I always like to say, I think it's high time in the white communities across the country that we prioritize a discussion about racism and not allow our uncomfortability. Because this is the thing that always gets me going is that, you know, yes, it's uncomfortable mostly for white folks to talk about racism. And but our uncomfortability should not come at the cost of safety for people of color around the country. We can't confuse those two terms. I personally have to throw myself into more uncomfortable conversations and moments in order to better increase safety for all across the country. And I think that's what you're talking about when you talk about in the marrow.
So the character that you developed, Quinn,
yeah,
the white kid on the basketball team, All-American boy, father was a hero, died in Afghanistan,
yeah,
all the rest. Tight with Galuzzo, the younger brother of the cop who did the beating,
yeah,
Rashad. So his growth and development in this, that's a big piece of the story. I mean, Rashad's one piece. The other piece of the story is this white kid who is wrestling with what he saw. He witnessed this thing happen. Are they going to find out? Am I on the video camera? What do I say? And if they call me to court, blah, blah, blah. And so talk about his development. I mean, from both your perspectives, I mean, is his development real?
I mean,
I'm not saying it's not. I'm just asking the question.
I appreciate it because, I mean, the reason why I smile as you ask the question is because it is a novel. And so, you know, there's only so much time we have.
You're right, exactly. So, volume two.
Miraculous things can happen in a short amount of time in fiction, whether it's in a book or it's on a TV show. But I do believe that it's real. I believe that I worked at a school in Manhattan for 10 years. I was teaching English, and I was around kids this age. And I was grateful to learn from that generation a lot about kids white kids who are wrestling with this conversation in a way that I certainly hadn't when I was growing up. And so I do think it's real because I've seen it. And I also think it's real in that Quinn is the you know, Quinn's sections are not just him having an existential crisis in his mind. It is him having conversations with his friends, some of whom are white, some of whom are black, some of whom are of Filipino descent. Mm-hmm. There are all kinds of different questions that he's grappling with, and in ways that he might not have before, because he's the kind of guy who thought like, hey, I'm a good guy. Like I have friends who are, you know, of different races. I'm a good guy. But he's never had to reflect on the privilege, the everyday privilege that allows him to escape the pain that begins the book. And so I absolutely do think it's real. And I think what's the part about it that I like the most is that it's because he's in conversation with other kids that gets him to sort of break down some of his personal assumptions.
I really do really appreciate what the two of you, I was going to say attempted, it may sound like you didn't do it, but attempted, but it really made happen here, because it's not something that I was trying to think of another novel or book I've read that was written by two men the way you wrote this book together to try to bring the white world in touch with the black world, the black world in touch with the white world, bringing the white world in touch with the real depth of what racism means in America from a black perspective and being felt and seen by a young white kid. You don't, I mean, I was really wrestling to looking, trying to look up stuff. Did someone else do this already?
Yeah. Yeah, it's weird because that's the one thing that some of the biggest compliments, you know, that's sort of the thing that I think was and is so different about this particular process is when we talk about racism in America, and Brendan always says this, when we talk about racism in America, typically the conversation, it's usually black people banging on the gate, right? It's black people banging on the gate of the castle saying, how come y'all don't, like open up the gate to the castle, instead of it being white people on the other side of that gate saying, we should probably open up the gate to the castle, right? Right? We never get that side of the story. And so I think it's a powerful thing to see white people talking about whiteness and racism.
It's very important. You've written a really important book, and I really, you know, I didn't know your book before they picked it. To tell you the truth, when they asked a bunch of us to pick other books, I didn't know your book, so I picked another book. Well, they didn't pick that book. They picked this book. But
that's fair.
But it's cool. I mean, because I hadn't read the book yet, and I just think that it's a really important piece of work for young people to read and for adults to read as well. I mean, y'all have done an amazing job writing collectively here.
Thank you.
And I'm not blowing smoke. I mean, this is phenomenal. You can meet these two gentlemen, Jason Reynolds and Brendan Kiley, tonight at 7 o'clock at the Oxon Hill Branch Library in Prince George's County. And get more information at www.mdhumanities.org/programs/1-Maryland-1book. That'll also be on a website, so it makes it easier to figure out what you're doing. So,
that's good to know.
But this is really an amazing piece, and I want to thank you both so much. Jason Reynolds, Brendan Kiley, the book is All American Boys. I think one of this year's really important novels. I can see it getting a lot of play and awards down the line here. This is really good.
Thank you, man. Appreciate
you. Thank you very much. Yeah.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll be talking with Tanya Bolden, one of our great authors, who wrote the book about the making of Smithsonian's National Museum African American History and Culture.